Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi everybody, welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. Today we are going to be talking about that turbulent decade, the 1980s, again the end of the 1980s, Margaret Thatcher, beloved by some, hated by others. What's the reality? We've got Dominic Sambrook talking to us. He's one of the most well-known popular historians in the UK. He's just written a brilliant book called Who Dares Wins, about the first few years of the Thatcher administration. We had a really interesting time because we talked a little bit about the politics, about the history of those years. And then I tried to step back a bit and ask him whether the things that he talks about, the cultural and political history of those years, is actually what they will be truly remembered for in decades and centuries to come. It was a really fun discussion about the nature of history itself. You will be able to see Dominic Sambrook on our history channel, historyhit.tv. You'll be able to hear ad-free versions of all these podcasts on historyhit.tv. You will be able to listen to all the podcasts from 2015 and 2016 exclusively on historyhit.tv. They are not available anywhere else on planet Earth. Head over to historyhit.tv, use the code POD6, P-O-D-6, and you get 6 weeks for free to check it out. In the meantime, though, everyone, here is Dominic Sambrook. Okay, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
A legend in the studio.
And I'm here too.
I'm going to start with, what's the most important decade to understanding the politics of the now, of all the ones you've studied?
It's a very boring answer, and I happen to have a book about it. But it's the true answer. I think it's probably the 80s.
You think so?
It's
yeah.
Probably the 80s when I guess you and I were both...
Very young. I mean, almost not born. Both of us.
Right, in your case, maybe. Yeah, I think it's probably the 80s. The 80s, you know, it's sort of classically Thatcher's decade. A huge shift economically for Britain. But I think it's also... I think the key thing about it is that it was the decade, it's the period in which Britain's sense of itself changed from the sort of... Britain rediscovered a kind of populist patriotism. And, I mean, this is a drum that's been beaten a lot in the last two or three years, but obviously an identity that was not European. I think it rediscovered that in the 80s. And coming so soon after having joined the European community in 1973. I think that was a big moment. I think Britain also rediscovered a kind of... if I say self-confidence, that makes it sound like I'm meaning that's a good thing. And I don't mean it in that way, but it did rediscover a kind of self-confidence and a belief that Britain was special and different and that Britain was dynamic and all these kinds of things.
And it sort of rebounded from imperial decline.
Yes. So in the 70s, it was all sort of, oh, woe is us. You know, the classic kind of James Callaghan, who was prime minister at the end of the 70s, who says, you know, when I'm shaving, I look in the mirror and I say to myself, if I was a younger man, I'd emigrate. To have your prime minister voicing those kind of sentiments is sub-ideal, I think, for any country. But nobody would have said that at the end of the 80s. I think even if people hated Thatcher and all she stood for and what she'd done to Britain, Britain was still a more dynamic, forward-thinking country. And I think once that happened, then Britain's sense of itself and its place in the world was bound to change. And European membership had always been presented to the British people and seen by them as a bit of a failure strategy. We've lost our empire, we have to find this new role and we don't like it, but we have to jump into bed with the Europeans. And I think once, particularly after the Falklands, once people started waving the flag again, then you'd get people saying, well, actually, maybe we don't need Europe. And I think that was absolutely transformative for Britain in our lifetimes.
And is it coincidence then that our current crop of leaders probably came of age? They sort of...
Yes. No, it's not coincidence. Yes, you're right. I think our current leaders are completely different, aren't they, from the people who preceded them, who were steeped in that world of post-imperial decline, who had lived through it, who had been born in the age of empire and had seen it fall apart around them. If you know your John le Carré in Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, the mole, I won't say who the mole is, the mole, one of the things that motivates him to give all the secrets to the Russians is that he feels cheated by the loss of empire. He was bred to run the empire and it's all been taken away, and there's this sense of Britain being irredeemably seedy and broken and rubbish. And for people of the sort of Ted Heath, James Callaghan, Harold Wilson generation, and those just below them, those a bit younger as well, I think that was fundamental to their sense of British identity and Britain's destiny. That Britain's destiny was a kind of reckoning with that, and an admission of it, and our future lay in accepting it and becoming, you know, a very big Belgium. And I think for politicians who came of age in the 80s and afterwards, their sense was very different. They remembered the Falklands, they remembered Thatcher in a handbag. You know, Blair always talked about Britain being a leader and, you know, standing shoulder to shoulder with the Americans, flying over to Bush's State of the Union address and accepting the congratulations of Congress and all of that kind of thing. And this sort of Churchillian rhetoric that Blair and Thatcher were both very comfortable with. So I think without all that, we wouldn't be where we are now.
When you've been looking at modern, recent British history, do you buy into that narrative, though, about how the sort of swings, you know, the 50s, the 70s being a nightmare and the 80s being a restoration of national pride? I mean, how much do you think that is a kind of us trying to talk about Britain on the sort of strategic on the world stage? What was the experience of normal Brits, do you think?
Oh, of course, it's completely different.
Yeah.
People's experience at any given moment is not the narrative that historians tell, is it? I mean, we superimpose that onto the messy reality of people's lives. So, you know, I've written books about the 70s and 80s and whatnot, and whenever I talk about them, people often say, well, I know what you're saying, but my life... And then they'll rattle off all the facts of their life, which was completely different. So in a way, you know that you're just painting a very, very broad picture that doesn't necessarily match the circumstances of an individual or an individual family's day-to-day life. But I still think you can make general points. I mean, you can make an observation in the 1970s, for example. You have this strange paradox where most people were better off than they'd ever been. They led more affluent lives, more comfortable, they went on foreign holidays, they had central heating, all of these kinds of things. And yet at the same time, they had an intense sense of disappointment with life hadn't quite measured up to their expectations in the 50s and 60s. They felt that Britain itself was falling behind, falling apart, more violent, more divided, all of those kinds of things. I mean, again, that is a generalisation, but I think it does capture something of the spirit of the time. And writing about these periods very intimately in sort of very great detail, you do get a sense of, at a given moment, the conversation is about, you know, X, Y, and Z. And then, almost imperceptibly, a few years later, it's about A, B, and C. It's about something different. And the obsessions are different. And the kind of flavour, I can't really put it any other way, the flavour of the national conversation feels different. I mean, as we all know from our own lifetimes, the flavour of the national conversation in 2007, let's say, was very different from 2015. And it's actually charting those changes, the obsessions that people have, their anxieties will change, their fantasies will change. That's one of the interesting aspects of writing about the very recent past.
Speaking about writing about the very recent past, what are your sources? I mean, how do you go about writing about when there's a ginormous reservoir of people to talk to and newspapers? And...
Well, first of all, I don't do people to talk to at all. Some people do, but I don't do it at all. I have done it for other things, and I'm just suspicious of it as a historical tool. People's recollections are generally wrong. And if you're talking to politicians, you're obviously getting a very carefully manicured, almost too self-reflective view of the past. But also, if you're trying to write the history of an entire country, I mean, who do you talk to? Where do you start? How are you going to select your housewife in Bolton to be representative? So I don't do that at all. I use mass observation, which came in the 1980s, after disappearing at the end of the Second World War. I use newspapers a lot, publish diaries. I mean, basically the issue is there's far too much stuff. So it's simply a matter of, you know, trying to get what you think is a reasonable balance. You know, some things are self-indulgent. There's no real, should we say, ideological justification for using Kenneth Williams's diaries, but they're good fun. And he's a very amusing, you know, spectator. So it would be mad not to. But I try to be pretty eclectic, you know, pop magazines, politicians' diaries, I do a lot about sport, I'll do sort of deep dives into things. So the Falklands War, obviously veterans' accounts, but also tons of the sort of cabinet papers, with the last book, you know, all basically Margaret Thatcher's papers have all been digitised. So there's no, I mean, you could spend your entire life sort of awash in Thatcher, which some people would really get off on, but there's a point at which you have to call a halt.
But also, unlike lots of historians working in earlier periods, I mean, you've got like hard data, you've got like job figures on him.
Yes, know. Yes.
I mean, are you part statistician?
I tell you what I use a lot is opinion polls. The two things that people generally get sort of cross about, they don't like me using, are newspapers and opinion polls. Generally because both of those things will present a picture that sometimes people don't want to hear. So people may have particularly an image of Britain as more progressive than it was. If you say, well, you know, at the end of the 1960s, New Society magazine did a really big survey and they asked people, what are the two things you don't like about Britain in the 60s? And young and old, rich and poor, they all gave the same answer. There's too many immigrants and we don't like the abolition of the death penalty. And, you know, sometimes I would mention this in talks and stuff and people would say, oh, that can't be right. You know, people, we weren't like that. Nobody I knew was like that. And the other thing is newspapers. People say, oh, well, the newspapers are all biased, aren't they? They're just trying to brainwash people and all the rest of it. But actually, I think newspapers, particularly the letters pages, can often give you a really fun view of what people are interested in. I mean, the letters that people write to the Daily Express or something at the turn of the 1980s look in many ways absolutely demented. But they're just a really fun and, I think, not entirely unrepresentative source. I do use a lot of, I mean, the opinion polls, particularly where it comes to stats, because you asked about stats. I mean, there's no cutoff. You could spend your life awash in facts and figures, you know, inflation, unemployment, interest rates, all of these kinds of things. And they do make a, you know, what the interest rate is, as anyone who owns a house or has a loan will know, makes a huge difference to your well-being, to your sense of how the country is faring and how you're faring in it.
Is it too soon to write history of the 80s and the 90s?
No. I mean, this is a sort of, you know, this is one of these things that people discuss, don't they, when they're studying historiography against their will in their second year at university, when does history start and end? I think about 30 years is about right. A.J.P. Taylor wrote about the interwar years in, I think, 1965. So similar sort of interval. I think there's just a sense after about 30 years of the dust settling a bit. So writing about Thatcherism now in the 80s now doesn't feel... It's still more politicised than I thought it would be, but it doesn't feel quite as intense as it would have done 10 or 20 years ago. A lot of people are dead. Makes it easier to write about them when they're dead, because you don't feel bad about saying what you think. And there's just a sort of sense of some of those stories have clearly ended. I think when people have died, You know, you know where we know what happened to them. You know what, where it got to. You know what happened to Thatcher and the Conservative Party and the Labour Party. So you can tell the story of the 80s with a sense of where it's going, in a way that you couldn't have done in 1995, let's say.
It's weird, though, isn't it? I mean, if the 2016 referendum had gone 2 points differently, so Remain had won.
I know.
You'd be writing different history books.
I would be writing different history. You're absolutely right. So I wrote the very first book in this series that I wrote, the European issue came up, because it was the late 50s, early 60s, when Macmillan made the first bid to enter. And I often think, I've often thought about it since the 2016 referendum, that that book and the next book, which was about Wilson's attempt to join, again vetoed by de Gaulle, and the third book, which had us actually joining, that all three of those I wrote with the assumption that we would be in forever. That the questions that I was asking were, why didn't we join earlier? What went wrong with the early applications? And then I would write about the celebrations. I can see it now. I've got the passage talking about the celebrations when we went in 1973. It didn't occur to me to write about the people who were really down in the dumps, you know, who were cross about it. And it didn't occur to me that the question that I should be asking was, why were more people not enthused? Why were so many people so sceptical? You know, which is obviously the question that you'd ask now. But you're absolutely right. You'd only ask that question now because of that 2 point difference. So it's a very good example about how, just a great example of how the vagaries of, you know, sophology in the present can change the questions that you're asking about the past.
So you admit, you know, that's good that you're writing, this is contemporary history. It's for you, it's affected by your experience moving through the present.
Yeah, isn't that true of all history?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's absolutely true of all history. I don't think that, it's more obvious for me.
Yeah.
But it happens in a more subtle way with anybody who writes about it. And you know, I see this all the time as a reviewer. So, you know, I review history books for the Sunday Times. And I get to, it's a great treat because I get to read lots of stuff outside my period. And I spend a lot of time talking to the literary editor about the obsessions that people have. So basically every book we get about the Victorians now is about, you know, it's either about empire and imperial crimes, or it's about people cross-dressing, or it's about sort of uproarious attempts to subvert the Victorian stereotype. People don't write books about Victorian politics or sort of straight Victorian history. And that is, of course, you know, that's contemporary writing. It's writing about the 21st century disguised as historiography, which in a sense all history is.
Join us this month on Gone Medieval from History Hit. I'm Matt Lewis.
And I'm Eleanor Yonaga. This April, dive into our special mini-series.
With the help of leading experts, we're tracing the foundations of England by exploring the country's most powerful Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
We'll be looking at Northumbria, Mercia, and Wessex, as well as the rulers and their councils who helped shape a nation.
Make sure to get every episode by listening and following Gone Medieval from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Totally. You mentioned Thatcher. She looms so large over modern British politics.
Yeah.
How easy was it to try and do a sort of dispassionate judgment on Thatcher? I mean, but the myths of both the right and the left are so powerful.
They are, aren't they? I mean, I always would say to people, Thatcher's the last great man in history. She's the last great. That's the last bit of great man history you're allowed. Particularly if you're very political. And oddly, particularly if you're left-wing and you hate Thatcher. Because if you're left-wing and you really hate her, people tend to believe that she is personally responsible for
deindustrialisation.
Precisely. Yeah. For these forces, which palpably she's not really personally responsible for at all. Because they happened everywhere. And because they were happening already. So in some... When I first started writing this, and it was an idea that I actually got from doing the TV series about the 80s. We had the idea of how could you do it with no Thatcher? Could you just take her out completely, not even mention her? What would it look like? And I thought, obviously I didn't do that for the book because she's such a great character. She's a great character. She's kind of Dickensian character, but it's a really interesting thought experiment. you know, write their story of Britain in the 1980s without mentioning her name or anything she did? How would, you know, how would your work on that change? And actually, once I started thinking like that, then it became almost easier to put her back in as a historical actor, but one who's imprisoned by circumstance, who's, you know, who's not the architect of the story, but is trapped within it, who's a professional woman who has to make decisions about what she's going to wear, how she's going to look, just like any other woman in the sort of new workplace of the 1980s. And as somebody who's wrestling with a, you know, she's been dealt a set of cards and she has to play them. And you know, that, I mean, I remember Margaret Thatcher when I was a child, but Jesus, I was, you know,
very
six,
young.
Seven, eight.
Hardly
I mean,
born.
It would be freakish. There are a lot of such people, but I wasn't one of these people who spent all my time thinking about Margaret Thatcher when I was young. I mean, I was thinking about Star Wars or something, but not Margaret Thatcher. So I didn't feel that I came to it with a lot of baggage. And having written about, you know, the McMillans and the Wilsons and so on, she was just fun to write about. She was so refreshing. She was so direct and acerbic and abrasive and at times sympathetic or intensely annoying. You know, she's a larger than life figure. I mean, that's a dreadful cliche. But if she was if historical characters were top trumps cards, she'd be a good card to get. You know, there's a lot of she's a technicolor character, and I think doing her that way as a character rather than as a caricature was the kind of key to it.
Do you think that so she's a great character, but did she have more agency? Was she sort of more powerful than your Wilsons and your Callaghans and these McMillans and other prime ministers? I mean, did she bend the course of British history more than
yes,
other prime ministers?
Yes, she did.
Okay.
She did. You know, if you take Wilson, for example, Wilson won 3 out of 4 elections that he fought. He was, you know, prime minister twice. He was a huge figure. I mean, the huge figure in the 60s and 70s. But when he left, you know, I've written thousands of pages about Harold Wilson. But when he left, you know, what was left? It was as though he'd never been. Now, with Thatcher, you really felt the imprint. I think she was just intensely forceful. I think she had a very, very, she was tactically far more flexible than her enthusiasts or her detractors would allow. So she was perfectly happy to do U-turns, despite the ladies not for turning stuff. But strategically, she was extremely consistent. She had a very clear vision of what sort of country she wanted to lead. How to get there was a different matter. But she was, you know, she was ruthlessly opportunistic, and absolutely unsentimental about using power, and about her own political survival, the survival of the Tory party. And she had a kind of, I think the other thing that's really distinctive about Margaret Thatcher, I mean, obviously there's a whole issue of her being a woman, which is, I'll park that for the moment. But I think the really distinctive thing is her moralism, which is utterly at odds with the kind of Macmillan, Wilson, Heath era. So she had been brought up in this intensely religious background, Methodist background, where she would go to church or to chapel sometimes 3 or 4 times a week on a Sunday. She was Sunday school and then various sort of things because her father was a lay preacher. She grew up in this atmosphere, this religious atmosphere, religious language. And when she became Tory leader, that was what a lot of people found both invigorating and shocking, is that she would use this language of good and evil completely unselfconsciously and unironically. So people would interview her. I mean, the Sunday Times interviewed her once and they said, why did you go into politics? And she said, well, because I believe in the conflict between good and evil and I believe that one day good will triumph. I mean, Harold Wilson would have never said something like this. You know, you can't imagine David Cameron saying anything like this, or Boris, or, you know, I mean, even Tony Blair, who is much more religious than most, would not have said it. She believed, you know, she genuinely thought that socialism was the way of wickedness. And of course, her enthusiasts loved that, because for once they were the goodies. Somebody was telling them they were on the side of virtue in there. But there's one reason I think why the left absolutely abhorred her, was that they were used to being unchallenged on the moral high ground. And here you had a prime minister who said, actually, I'm fighting the fight of righteousness, and you are villains who are undermining, you know, all this sort of stuff. And that made her completely different from most other politicians. I mean, people in her own cabinet would kind of, you know, they would physically recoil when she sort of embarked on these lectures. But if you see her, you can see her speech notes that she would write for the party conference speeches. And she would write these huge screeds about the idea of individual responsibility and how that comes from God and all of this sort of stuff. And of course, her speechwriters would cut every word of it because they were just embarrassed by it. They didn't know what to do with it. But she absolutely believed it. And that made her very different from most politicians. And that she allied that with two other things. One is the opportunism, the sort of ruthless tactical cunning. And the third thing, which is very telling, is the populism. She framed everything within the language of the family and the household. I know how to handle a family budget. You probably know yourself, so you know. And she'd gone about inflation, and she presented in this way, which is where being a woman came in very handy, because she could play that card. And that, again, was something that a lot of politicians just couldn't do. So she had all these sort of qualities, for want of a better word, and she was a sort of... She was a very powerful electoral package in a way that only really, I suppose, Blair has matched since her.
What about when you're writing, when you've been writing these histories, you know, these modern histories? Is it easy to get obsessed by the trees and ignore the wood? I mean, do you? Because I have historians coming here and talking about demographics and climate breakdown and AI do you sound as a kind of culture? Is that your primary interest? Is the culture and political history, or are you trying to also map these kind of gigantic substructural change like tech that's going on as well? Because it's a huge task.
Yeah, the truthful answer is yes, I do try to do those things, but it's kind of difficult in an 800 page book about 3 or 4 years. So, you know, you're trying to keep the rhythm of several different. Or the pace of several different stories in your mind at once. So one is the level of political froth, which, as we all know, is in the long run trivial. And below that are the bigger things. So you mentioned tech. In the most recent book, I have a chapter about computers. And a lot of people were quite surprised when I said I was going to do a whole chapter, surely a page. And I'd say, no, I think this is really... I do think... No one will care in the long run about the miners' strike, maybe not even the Falklands War. But the advent of the computer, in terms of a computer as something we all use, you know, it's colossal. And I remember it happening. I remember everybody in my class, that moment when nobody had ever seen a computer, and that moment where everybody had a Commodore 64 or a Spectrum or a BBC Micro. And that, of course, is merely a trivial symptom of a much deeper change in the way we relate to each other and the way we work and all the rest of it. So I do try to weave some of that in. But of course, that's a classic example of a story that hasn't ended.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's hard to say exactly where that's going. But yes, you know, there is a real danger of... I have an awful lot of trees in my books because they're quite, you know, they're designed to be immersive. You know, the weather on a given day, who was top of the first division, all of that kind of thing, and kind of giving you a building up the texture of life. But certainly, I sometimes think you can absolutely get too close to all this stuff, and you can suffer from an overload of information. And actually, that's one thing that, being not just a historian but a newspaper columnist, I always think that actually a real asset for writing columns or talking about contemporary politics is not overloading yourself with information, most of which is wrong or misleading, but actually shutting off from it and knowing. So I don't want to sound like saying knowing as little as possible, but sometimes the more you know, the more you become absorbed by the minutiae, the more you lose sight of the bigger picture and you lose the kind of clarity of vision. So trying to keep all those, I don't know what metaphor I'm on now with clarities of vision, trees and woods and balls in the air. But trying to keep all those balls in the air is the trick, I guess.
Yeah, so when you're... Is it so interesting? Because you're the great expert of modern British history. You looked at how we've evolved and developed. And you just said political stuff's all froth. And I kind of agree with that as well. It just strikes me that... You know, I come from a family of political journalists who would just get obsessed by a party conference speech.
Yes.
And I think... Did that make any difference compared to what the woman down the road was doing, which was developing a cancer drug? You know, like, what do you think the big, like, what have been the big things that have driven change over the period that you've studied? I mean, has it been decisions made by men and women in white?
No.
You don't think so?
No, of course not. I mean, here's a way to think about it. The Victorian period, right? I mentioned the Victorian period earlier. Think of the Victorian period when Britain was at the height of its international influence, when colossal change, the railways, cities, Dickens, you know, newspapers, steamships, all that stuff. Who cares now who was prime minister in 1874? Who knows the details of Gladstone's second government? I mean, that stuff is no more compelling than the details of the reign of a Byzantine emperor from the 7th century or something. I mean, those things might be interesting, you know, to some people, and they might enjoy it, but it doesn't feel... It doesn't have, you know, weight. It doesn't seem to have significance. And I think, you know, the funny thing about my books and the way I write is that I do give a lot of weight to all those things, and I enjoy the narrative, but it doesn't really matter. You know... Heretical as it might sound, it didn't actually really matter. That did it matter that Margaret Thatcher won in 1979 and not Labour? Probably not. Would Britain be in a different position now? Would our lives be different? No, because as you say, the technological changes, the sort of deep cultural and economic shifts have nothing to do with politicians. And that's often... But we all like to collude in this fantasy.
Totally. We want someone to be in charge.
We want someone to be in charge. But also, I think there's a fine line between an ideology, a historical explanation, a conspiracy theory. And we all like to believe that somebody is to blame. That somebody, you know, the evil Tories plotted all this and they destroyed our industry.
Well, I think we want to believe that Rupert Murdoch can click his hands and make... Because otherwise it's all a bit scary.
It is,
If no one's in charge, then it's, oh my God.
If JFK really was just shot by Lee Harvey Oswald, how worrying is that, that the world can spin because of the actions of one madman?
Yeah. George W. Bush, it was just a bit of a bumbling fool. There was no overarching kind of conspiracy.
Yes, there was no plan.
Just a bit of an idiot.
Yeah.
And he didn't know what was going on.
Yeah. I mean, you sort of see this now with Cummings and Brexit.
Oh, yeah, people want Cummings to be the evil genius.
To be the mastermind.
Even if they hate him. They want. Yes, they think it's nice that somebody's...
Yeah.
I remember that Peter Mandelson. Do you remember? Yeah. Oh, he's the dark art. He's going to...
Darkness.
Yeah, it's whatever. No, he's not. He's just a dude. He's just wandering around like everyone else. I mean, I just don't... I don't see that any of these people have agency, really.
Well, the more you know about politics and politicians and political history, as you do about of medieval kings or anybody else, is that they're fumbling, arguing, squabbling, you know... Trying to make sense of the world, and the most successful ones are the best opportunists. But that's all it is. But that's not what we want to... I mean, you could write history books with no people in them. And people do. Sort of guns, germs and steel and all the rest of it. It's a successful genre. I mean, it's not what I am particularly interested in. And actually, the sort of human comedy, as it were... I mean, that's what often strikes me about... My books are a succession of people getting things wrong, making tits of themselves in various ways, you know, political careers crashing and burning after having appeared to soar into the heavens. And that's fun, because there's a sort of... I think there is a kind of human comedy aspect to politics, which is often what political journalists really like about it. The sort of... the multiple ironies of all these people who think they're, you know, they're the big I am, as it were. And actually, they've just got feet of clay like all the rest of us. And we project onto them all this meaning. But it doesn't really exist.
There you go. So what's the latest book?
So the latest book is called Who Dares Wins. And it's Britain 1979 to 1982. And I believe available in all good bookshops.
It sure is. Go and buy it, everyone. Thank you very much for coming to the podcast.
Dan. Thank you.
I feel the hand of history upon our shoulders.
I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Just before you go, bit of a favour to ask. I totally understand if you don't want to become a subscriber or pay me any cash money. Makes sense. But if you could just do me a favor, it's for free. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. If you give it a 5-star rating and give it an absolutely glowing review, purge yourself, give it a glowing review. I'd really appreciate that. It's a tough world out there, law of the jungle out there, and I need all the fire support I can get. So that will boost it up the charts. It's so tiresome. But if you could do it, I'd be very, very grateful. Thank you.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.